Monadnock region later this afternoon. We'll see highs from the upper 50s in the White Mountains in North Country to mid-60s in the south today, about 60 along the coast. Tonight, partly to mostly cloudy with some fog reforming after midnight. Temperatures between 35 and 42 overnight. Wednesday, partly sunny north of the lakes, mostly sunny to the south, with temperatures once again in the upper 50s to mid-60s. In Portsmouth, it's up to 58 degrees now. In Nashua, it's 42. In Keene, 43. In Lebanon, it is 44 degrees. In Gorham, it's 46. And in Concord, it's 42 degrees. I'm Rick Anley. This is New Hampshire Public Radio News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The U.S. Justice Department is now suing three states, challenging their new strict immigration laws, Arizona, Alabama, and just last month, South Carolina. Other states in recent years have also approved tougher rules regarding who can and who can't be within their borders, and giving local police and schools more involvement in that area. New Hampshire laws haven't changed, but the state entered this discussion about 5 years ago, when officers in two towns pulled over drivers who, it turned out, were in this country illegally. The officers charged them with trespassing and tried to get federal immigration authorities to take action, but were told to let the men go. These cases added in to an ever-growing debate over how much authority states and communities have over immigration. But while the arguments and lawsuits and policies fly back and forth, they're really nothing new. Questions over who should be allowed to come here from abroad go way back, from the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882 to a Mexican guest worker program of the World War II era to the post-9/11 USA Patriot Act, which included provisions aimed at foreigners living here who might be plotting terrorism. Today in The Exchange, as part of our year-long look at New Hampshire's immigration story, we examine immigration law, how it keeps evolving, and the political and economic forces which drive those changes. Also, the current debate over what role the state should play in carrying out national immigration policy. Let's hear from you, too. What has history taught us about the way immigration should be handled? When have we gotten it right, in your opinion, and when have we gotten it wrong? The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Our guests are Ron Abramson, New Hampshire lawyer and founder of Abramson Immigration Solutions, an immigration law firm based in Manchester. Ron, good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Laura. Thanks for having me.
Also joining us from D.C., Mark Krikorian, executive director of the Center for Immigration Studies, an independent nonprofit research organization. And Mark, welcome back to The Exchange. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, and Mark, I want to turn to you first. You know, it's been said that our immigration law over our history reflects our ambivalence about immigration. And I wonder what you think, Mark, you know, looking over time, how do our policies toward those coming from the outside reflect what's happening inside our borders?
Well, immigration clearly, immigration policy has reflected a certain ambivalence because the American people have always been ambivalent about immigration. There's always been winners and losers from it. There have been, you know, costs and benefits. And sort of over time, depending on circumstances and a lot of things, our immigration policy has fluctuated. And, you know, I mean, I really think it's more, it's not so much a function of the changes in people's views, but changes in society itself and the economy and what have you that then result in different reactions to immigration.
So changes in society such as, Mark, you know, a bad economy, people say no immigrants, a booming economy, hey, we need more immigrants to fulfill these jobs.
Sure. I mean, that's part of it. But even earlier, you know, open land, when there's a lot of land, actually there was, a desire for immigration to settle the land. But even more recently, around, you know, after World War One and then World War Two again and the War on Terror, security concerns have also been part of the equation. After World War One, concerns about Bolshevism and anarchists and that sort of thing. So it's a combination of a whole variety of things that kind of percolates into varying policies over the years.
Well, Ron, what do you think? We've always been ambivalent about immigration over time. You see it with the ebbs and flows of these laws.
I'm not sure we've always been publicly ambivalent. I mean, in the early days, there were no restrictions. First 100 years of America, we had basically open borders. We were encouraging people to come because we needed the labor, we needed the masses to build the country. It's when there's a perception among those who are rooted here that there's scarcity, that there's fear, that you start having a sense of, in some cases, ambivalence. And if you mean it nationally, yes, we've been ambivalent. And in other cases, complete and total restrictionism bordering on xenophobia.
Well, and pick up on that if you could, Ron. You know, you're right. We didn't really have immigration laws setting out broad policy until the 1880s. Why so late, Ron?
Because we didn't feel that we needed to codify it. It wasn't a problem. It was part of the growth of this country. This country was, you know, the world's first sort of multi-ethnic experiment in a free democracy. And at least until that point, despite some setbacks, it had worked out pretty well. And we started reacting to certain situations. We started identifying national origin groups. And Mark's right. Fear born out of security concerns after World War I, World War II, and other more recent events have led to harsher, more tightly regulated immigration law.
So before this time, Mark, before 1880, how easy or hard was it to become a citizen? Could you just show up and fill out some papers and say, hey, I'm an American?
Well, I mean, Ron's right, is that there really were no, before the 1880s, there was very little, there was no federal immigration restrictions or even just regulations of any kind. There were various state laws, and even back into the colonial era, most of those, though, involved people becoming what's called a public charge. In other words, trying to keep people out who would end up, going on the dole or whatever equivalent of the dole there was back then. But, see, part of the reason we saw this elaboration of federal immigration regulation starting in the late 1800s is because that's when a whole variety of other legal regimes were created. In other words, there was no, there was no food safety laws, occupational safety and health laws, securities laws. All of that stuff was part of the development of a modern regulated state, and immigration, the immigration laws are really just part of that same process. So to say that we had no immigration regulation at the federal level before then is true, but we also had nothing about safety of your food, rules about monopoly, business practices, all of that kind of stuff all developed about the same time.
So that's interesting. So before the 1880s, you really don't see this federal government getting involved in these broad policy issues. It's kind of up to the states then, Mark, to do what they see fit.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, before Ellis Island was established by the feds, New York itself, New York State, was in charge of immigration intake on its own for the whole country. It's kind of interesting, but that's the way it worked. But again, we had a much more decentralized governmental system in all respects. And so federal immigration law, the development of it, really parallels the development of federal law and regulation in all other areas.
Well, and now we're seeing sort of a reversal where the states are getting more involved in national immigration policy. And we'll talk about that a little bit later in this show. I want to invite our listeners to join us too, though, gentlemen. Our number here on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. And today in the exchange, as part of NHPR's year-long series on New Hampshire's immigration story, we're looking more closely at the history of immigration law. What do you think? What has history shown us about the way immigration should be handled in the legal sense? When have we gotten it right? When have we gotten it wrong? And what do you make of more recent state laws giving state and local officials more authority to enforce federal immigration law? Our number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. The email exchange at nhpr.org. And Ron, just following this arc of history for a couple more minutes, if we could, both you and Mark talked about the anxiety, during World War I and that era leading up to World War II created a clamping down on immigration. After World War II, really during that war and up to the 60s, Ron, you see a loosening again. What was happening then economically, politically, that led to an easing of these statutes?
I think it was a combination of factors. Obviously, World War II, despite all the tragedy and all the loss, solidified this country economically because everybody pulled together. We came out of World War II in a, as the world's leading economic power, sort of undisputed at that time. And there was also this sense of the massive tragedy and displacement of people throughout the war and throughout the world. And we had a sense that we would be welcoming to people who needed sanctuary, who needed a stable place to come and build a new life, in particular, victims of the European theater and tragedies and, in some cases, of the South Pacific.
So moral reasons and economic reasons.
Right. We also passed the War Brides Act which allowed about 118,000 alien spouses of servicemen to come into the United States. And we were we had a sort of brief open window, if you will, and then we ran smack into McCarthyism and some of the antics of the 50s.
But after that, Mark, the 1960s, the civil rights era, how did that influence our feelings about immigration, given those struggles within our own borders?
Well, the changes that you saw in the immigration law, which passed in 1965, that's kind of the watershed year that kicked off the current wave of immigration, were really seen as a civil rights measure. Because the immigration law at that point, the one that had been passed in the 20s and then revised again in the 50s, had what they call national origins quotas, you know, a certain number of people from Italy, a certain number from Germany, that sort of thing. And they were clearly intended to let in, you know, fewer people from Southern and Eastern Europe and more people from Northern and Western Europe. And so it was seen, I think correctly, as, you know, having these invidious elements of national origins. And so in 1965, eventually, it was changed, but it was not seen as some kind of important change in the nature of immigration. It was just seen as a way of cleaning up this these archaic pieces of our immigration law, because everybody at the time openly and publicly said that immigration was over, that it was part of our nation's past and a very important part, but like you know, pioneers going on the Oregon Trail, it was just that, history. It had receded in the past, and the changes that were being made in the 60s were just a matter of almost kind of legal hygiene, cleaning up these embarrassing provisions, but not with any intention of actually restarting something that had faded into the past.
Immigration is over. They said that in the mid-60s, Mark?
Absolutely. I mean, that was the whole Jack Kennedy said it in his book, Nation of Immigrants. LBJ said it when he signed the immigration law. Everybody testifying about, you know, before Congress about the change in the law said, this is not going to increase immigration. That's not the point. That's all part of our past, or an important part, a valued part of our past, but nonetheless part of our past. And this will just make the immigration law less problematic. Again, as a kind of civil rights measure, and also as a kind of Cold War measure, because the Soviets would point to these discriminatory provisions in the Third World and say, look, the Americans are bad, come and, you know, buy guns from us.
Yeah, so much of that era is colored by the Cold War. We'll talk more about that after a short break. I also want to ask both of you just for some basic definitions of immigrant, refugee. There's some confusion there. And then, gentlemen, we will talk about those state laws on immigration that have been making big headlines. All of that, plus your calls at 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Stay with us.
Good morning. It's 9:19, and support for New Hampshire Public Radio comes from you, our members, and from St. Mary's Bank, the nation's first credit union, helping New Hampshire families and businesses grow and prosper for over 100 years. Online at stmarysbank.com. From Restaurant Week Portsmouth in the Seacoast, a 10-day culinary experience featuring 42 restaurants November 3rd to the 12th. Details at restaurantweekportsmouth.com. And University of New Hampshire School of Law and its Franklin Pierce Center for Intellectual Property, pioneering in practical legal education for New Hampshire and the world at law.unh.edu. More on the history of immigration law on The Exchange on NHPR, then at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, protecting children from sexual abuse. New Hampshire weather today, partly to mostly sunny for most of the state, mild with highs reaching the mid-60s. Parts of interior southern New Hampshire may reach the upper 60s. It'll be partly sunny for the North Country today with high temperatures in the upper 50s. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, as part of our year-long look at New Hampshire's immigration story, we're digging into immigration law, its history, as well as current controversies. Let's hear from you. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. Our guests are Mark Krikorian, Executive Director of the Center for Immigration Studies, and Ron Abramson, a New Hampshire lawyer and founder of Abramson Immigration Solutions. One more time, the number, 1-800-892-6477. The email exchange@nhpr.org. And gentlemen, we've talked a lot about just how much immigration law has fluctuated and changed over the years, given changing political and economic considerations in this country. I want to just back up for a couple minutes, if we could, please. And Ron, turn to you. What's the official definition of who's an immigrant? Because I think there's some confusion around that.
Sure. The problem with terms in this debate or this discussion is that there are layperson's definitions and understandings, and there are legal definitions. An immigrant, legally speaking, is a person who is in the United States with permission to remain indefinitely.
So not a tourist.
Not a tourist, not a student, not a worker, not a guest in any way, shape, or form. It's somebody who's not a U.S. citizen, but has the permission to remain here and is also known as a lawful permanent resident once they arrive.
Okay.
So the term illegal immigrant is actually oxymoronic, because you can't, I mean, I suppose you could argue that a person has the intent to remain here, but they're illegally doing so. But those of us in the immigration advocacy and lawyers field called that an undocumented individual. So an immigrant is a term of art. Everybody else who's here legally or otherwise, but who has a foreseeable expiration as to their status, is called a non-immigrant.
Interesting.
Pretty straightforward.
And how is the definition of a refugee different, Ron?
A refugee is a person who has been deemed persecuted on one of five bases that U.S. law identifies, and is admitted here essentially as a sanctuary to escape the persecution from either where they're from or where they were last living.
And this you may not be able to answer, but I'll ask you anyway, both you and Mark. Ron, what percentage of immigrants do you think want to become citizens versus the percentage who are happy to live here but want to maintain citizenship of that home country?
My anecdotal experience, because I deal with the whole realm of the immigration experience, from people trying to get visitors' visas to people trying to become U.S. citizens, is that more people are oriented towards becoming U.S. citizens, especially in light of some of the volatility in changes in the law in the last 10, 15 years, where in 1996 the law changed and expanded the scope of what we call removable offenses, meaning what kinds of crimes can get a person deported. The only safety against having a minor thing turn into a major immigration problem is to become a U.S. citizen through the process of naturalization.
So making that status a little more stable just in case.
Correct. And you get to vote. And there's been a modern trend towards the recognition that we live in a more global world, and that becoming a citizen of one country doesn't mean you have to renounce the citizenship of your home country, of your original
country.
That used
to be the case, right? You become an American citizen and you couldn't be a German citizen anymore.
Well,
has that changed?
The U.S. law for a long time has actually been that we don't encourage it. We discourage multiple citizenship, but we don't ban it outright. And it's always been a matter of the law of the originating country to determine.
What do you think, Mark? What percentage of immigrants living here now legally want to become citizens versus just living here legally but maintaining home citizenship, home country citizenship?
Well, I mean, that's the kind of thing that requires, you know, social science.
Right.
But the only thing you can really confidently say is that there's a lot of both. There is a significant number of people who clearly come here with the intention of becoming Americans. In other words, they're basically shedding their old clothes and putting on American ones, and that's it. But there's also a large number of people, and I would guess probably a larger number than the first group, who sort of plan to go home at some point. They may not have real concrete plans, but they're not thinking of this as something that's, you know, becoming a member of a new people and washing their hands of the old country and all that sort of thing. What happens, though, is over time, you know, people change. People grow, they develop, you know, they come here, work for a few years, earn some money, they're going to go back and buy a cab, say, back in Accra in Ghana. But then, you know, birds and bees, they have a couple of kids, and then they bring this up at the dinner table one day, and the kids are like, what are you, crazy? You're not going back to Ghana. And, you know, that happens. You get used to it. You get used to a place where people drive between the lane markings on the road, which doesn't happen. And I've lived in the Middle East. It doesn't work that way, where cops don't shake you down every time you're stopped, that sort of thing. And so what you end up with is, over time, more and more people who figured they were going to go back decide they're going to have to stay.
And with the exception of serious criminals and so forth, Mark, Are there some law-abiding immigrants that will never be granted citizenship? The government will just say, no, sorry? I guess I'm trying to get a sense of how hard it is to be a citizen if you really want to be.
It's not really that difficult if you really want to. There's several hurdles. One of the biggest, actually, for a lot of people is the cost. Because Congress doesn't fund the immigration services part of the bureaucracy, it all comes through fees. All of their money comes through fees. So they've actually had to jack up the fees. It's now close to $700 to apply for citizenship, to do all of the various different fees you have to pay. If that's not a problem, or if you overcome that, the rest of it isn't that difficult, really. I mean, there's very few countries in the world that make acquiring citizenship as easy as here. For most people, you have to have a green card, in other words, be a lawful permanent resident for 5 years, for most people. And then you pass, frankly, relatively easy English language and history and civics tests. You know, you get fingerprinted and they check and see if you're a criminal or a dope dealer or whatever. And, you know, that's really about it. I mean, it's not that hard if you want to do it. And that's the question. Are you willing to put in some of the time and the money?
Is it hard, Ron? What do you think? You deal with people all the time.
That Mark's description encapsulates the process. You have to go back and show that you've been a person of, quote, good moral character, as defined by certain rules and regulations for the last 5 years before you apply. I think the harder part is getting that green card in the first place. That's where we're more restrictive. That's where you have many more challenges. But if you can get your green card and you can stay out of trouble and learn even, you know, the fundamental rules in English, and, you know, he's right, it's not a particularly challenging examination in terms of English fluency, and they've retooled the civics and history test to make it a little more practical and a little more useful. Yeah, we don't put a lot of barriers up to citizenship. It's more documentary, if a person's been divorced, if they've been charged with a crime, but it was dismissed. There's still all sorts of certified paperwork that has to be submitted. So it's not substantively that difficult, but it can be procedurally rather involved.
One more technical question, and then we'll get back into the policy issues and take your calls. So if you're on the line, stay there. Ron, we talked a little bit about refugees. Do refugees automatically get put on a path to citizenship? Again, these are people who, you know, are fleeing persecution, war. They'll be killed if they stay in their home countries. The State Department allows them in and sends them to certain communities. Are they automatically granted citizenship if they want it?
Not at all. Refugees are admitted in that status. They are allowed to stay here indefinitely. They are allowed to work. They have to wait 1 year before they can apply for a green card. Some do, some don't. For refugees in particular, as Mark pointed out, the costs, the filing fees are often prohibitive because these are people just learning the new culture and just scraping by. They get very minimal government assistance when they resettle. And and then they're in the same boat as everybody else. The difference for refugees is, in theory, if they were to be put into what's called removal proceedings, which is deportation, they would be able to claim that the harm from which they fled could be a reason why they shouldn't be deported at this point if there's some basis to do that. But there are no free rides or passes for refugees or asylees.
All right, let's take some calls, gentlemen. Our number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Join us today on The Exchange as we look at the history of immigration law. It's part of NHPR's year-long series on New Hampshire's immigration story. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. And up first is Laura in Manchester. Hi, Laura, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you. It's glad to talk to you all. I enjoy the show. So you were just talking about refugees who are claiming asylum. And in Manchester, I do see a lot of refugees. They're coming to the schools. They're living with six or seven people in these small apartments. At what point do we legally have to say, you know, yes, we understand that you're being persecuted in your home country, but we just don't have the room for you to live a safe and productive life?
So at what point do we say no? And are you talking about immigrants and refugees, Laura, or more the refugees?
Well, I mean, the immigrants, you know, are taking the legal path to come into the country, and we have that status quo. But the refugees, it seems like they don't have a choice.
And so what is the State Department doing about that? And we've done whole programs on that, but it's an important question. Laura, thanks for calling in. You know, Mark, you may be familiar with our Queen City, Manchester, where Laura lives. They've been dealing with this back and forth on refugees. There was a moratorium on refugees a couple years ago. Now some in Manchester want another moratorium. What do you think about Laura's concerns, Mark?
Well, I mean, they're legitimate concerns. And frankly, in any area of immigration law, there are literally millions and millions of people who qualify under the UN definition of a refugee. And we're not, you know, we're only going to be taking the tiniest fraction of them. And there's a couple of issues there. First of all, are we taking the people who are genuinely the most desperate? And the answer is no, for the most part. We're taking people, you know, who are politically appealing in some way or another, rather than the people who really are the most desperate and have nowhere else to go. But also, there's the question that the caller brought up, the impact on communities. So what happens is the State Department basically just ships these people into the United States and, frankly, doesn't have all that much concern about where they go or what kind of impacts or giving communities a heads up beforehand, any of that stuff. I mean, really, the State Department basically considers it not to be their problem. And this really is something that's percolating up from the bottom. Tennessee just passed a law requiring notification of communities before refugees are settled. And you're going to see a lot more of that kind of pushback over the next few years.
Now, just because Tennessee says it wants notification, does the State Department really have to listen to what Tennessee says, Mark?
No, of course not. I mean, and obviously they'll just pretty much ignore it. But my point is that it's an indication of the discontent in a lot of communities. And the interesting thing is you see this with the refugee issue, because unlike regular immigrants who go to, you know, major gateway cities and immigrant communities, refugees initially are settled by the State Department and by these organizations that live off its contracts in communities all over the country, lots of small towns with no immigration, no existing pre-existing immigrant community. And it creates much more disruption in these small places than it does if the same number of immigrants showed up in L.A. or New York. And that's why you see such political controversy and pushback in these communities.
And, you know, throughout this series, we're going to be exploring these concepts. And next week, we will be looking at the impact of immigration and refugees on the schools that Laura mentioned. But, Ron, I do want to get you in here. You know, you have heard these concerns from some folks in Manchester. As Laura said, we don't have room. What do you think?
At some point, it's possible that we may not have room. We are nowhere near reaching that point. And I think the real issue and the real challenge here is not to change our tone or our decision to welcome those who are fleeing persecution, but to execute it better. You know, Mark is right. The State Department, it's just not good form. It's just not good relations between different sovereigns, the federal government and the local government, to dump people and say, our work is done, we're going to fund a social staffing agency, a social service agency, and, you know, they can have a minimal rent subsidy, and that's about it. I mean, it is really, we should make it so that people are truly welcome, so that there is multiple layers of support, and so that people can integrate and assimilate, if they so choose, as quickly as possible and become productive members of society. There are anecdotal stories of communities that have not been very welcoming, and there are also some success stories where communities have been revitalized by the influx of refugees, and there have been a number of small businesses that have started up and a whole new economic circles and cycles that have been created by the resettlement of new immigrants.
Let's take another call. Laura, thanks for that one. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Peter's calling in from Vermont. Hi, Peter. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi there. Thanks for the discussion. Although I really find most discussions regarding restriction of immigration to be particularly offensive, I believe in treaties, and we're signatories to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in the United Nations, which pretty much erased borders except for those fleeing legitimately recognized prosecution. This nation was built on immigration, and we continue to find that immigrants are necessary for especially the biggest growth industries. And I think it's kind of foolhardy to attempt to restrict immigration. And you know, one of the other things, and then I'll be done, is that a lot of industry, I believe, especially big agri, has a vested interest in keeping the illegal immigration or undocumented alien situation going. because without it, we wouldn't have this underclass that they're able to ill-treat due to the fact that these poor folks fly under the radar.
Well, and Peter, thanks for calling in, and lots of points there. And Marco, I want to pick one up, though. He says, look, this nation was built on immigration, and we continue to find it important. You have written, Mark, that immigration is an important part of our past, but it's not our future. Give us more there, please.
Well, the basic point that I try to make there is that today's immigrants really aren't that different from those of the past. Yes, they come from different countries, but, you know, they're not that different from your grandpa from Sicily or your grandma from Lithuania. What's different is us. Our society has changed fundamentally over the past century. We have now a post-industrial knowledge-based economy. We have a welfare state. Advances in technology shrink the world. And all of those things have changed us in good and bad ways, but they're parts of what it is to be a modern society. And mass immigration conflicts with those characteristics in ways that just wasn't true in the past. When you take large numbers of people, they're inevitably going to be disproportionately less educated because, you know, a lot of well-educated people, some of them still come here, but generally, if you're in good shape, you're not going to leave. It's people who are poor. When you're taking people from 100 years ago, poor people from Sicily or somewhere else into the United States, they were coming to a place that wasn't that different from their home country, a little bit different, but not that different. Now you're taking 19th century style workers still, but they're coming into a 21st century modern society. And that mismatch creates real problems. Again, not because the immigrants are different, but because we're different, and we need to change our policy, in my opinion, to reflect that reality.
Change the policy to restrict immigration more?
To limit immigration. I mean, not zero immigration. I spell this out in some mind-numbing detail in my book, available on Amazon. But the point, basically, is not zero immigration, but zero-based budgeting. Start at zero. And then look at which groups of people are so compelling to let in, mainly the spouses and minor children of U.S. citizens, which is a very strong case. We've never limited that. But the point is, look at the very narrow groups of people we want to let in and then come up with a system that lets all of them in every year but has a much lower level of overall immigration.
I wonder about, you talk about the economic mismatch. What about, you know, some of that backbreaking farm work or, you know, working in a meatpacking plant? We hear about employers who say they want to hire local, but Americans don't really want those hard, low-paying jobs.
Well, the hard and low-paying are the adjectives that matter. The fact is, if we were still doing farm work in, say, you know, North Dakota, the way it was done in, you know, harvesting wheat in North Dakota, the way it was done in Virginia in the 1700s by hand with a scythe, nobody would be doing that either. Much of farm work, that's the most immigrant-heavy part of the labor force, and it's relatively small, but it's very visible. You know, the mechanization of that harvesting of fresh fruits and vegetables exploded when we cut off the guest worker program that we had with Mexico in the 60s. And then when illegal immigration over time got big enough to make a difference, that agricultural mechanization stopped. In other words, or slowed down a lot. There's nothing that requires, in a modern society, that requires huge numbers of low-skilled immigrants every year being admitted. It's just that when you keep doing that, the industries adapt to take advantage.
And Mark, we will talk more after a short break, so stay right with us.
Today, a special word-of-mouth presentation of Writers on a New England Stage with Chuck Palahniuk. His books Fight Club and Choke have inspired a cultish following. I'll talk with him about his new book, kind of Judy Blume meets Dante's Inferno, and about walking through the fire of his own family's dark past. I'm Virginia Prescott. That's a conversation with Chuck Palahniuk today at noon and again at 9 p.m. on NHPR.
Support for New Hampshire Public Radio comes from UR members, MPS&H, thanking its employees, contractors, state and local officials, and emergency responders for their teamwork during the recent storm, and thanking its customers for their patience. And Tupelo Music Hall, presenting singer-songwriter and social activist Chadwick Stokes, December 2nd in Londonderry and December 3rd in White River Junction. Tickets at tupelohall.com. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the history and current debate over immigration law. This is part of NHPR's year-long series on New Hampshire's own immigration story. Let's hear from you this hour as we look at the history, as we dig into some of the current debates. What do you think? What has history shown us about the way immigration should be handled? When do you think we've gotten it right? When do you think we've gotten it wrong? And what do you make of more recent state laws giving state and local officials more authority to enforce federal immigration law? Our number here in The Exchange for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. The email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Ron Abramson, I want to give you a chance to jump in this discussion we're having with Mark Krikorian. He says in his book that, look, this is an important part of our past. We respect it. We revere it. But our current economy doesn't need large numbers of poor, unskilled immigrants. Time for a change.
Mark gave an eloquent soliloquy on what his position is and where it comes from, and I have not written a tome on the subject myself, but it's something I've thought a lot about and deal with every day when I'm trying to help people navigate the system. And the fact is that it's a sort of incomplete argument or an incomplete analysis, and there's an inherent paradox in the restrictionist movement that has to do with free markets. Most of the people who consider themselves restrictionists would also support free markets, and a lot of us who are advocating immigration reform would say that we should let the market regulate many of the non-immigrant worker visas. I'll give you an example. There's a program called the H-1B. That's specialty occupations, generally requires a bachelor's degree or higher. There's a cap every year, fiscal year, of 65,000. When the economy was humming along, 65,000 was insufficient, was raised for 2 years to 115,000. That was barely sufficient, went back to 65,000, and they had to have a lottery because they were filing 100,000-plus applications on the first day.
Wow.
So now, with the economy having taken a dip and with businesses realizing that H-1Bs are not a reliable way to staff high-level employment, there are still H-1B visas available for fiscal year 2011-2012. And here we are in November, whereas they were gone on the first day of April when they were applied for in the years past. So the market can regulate a lot. I can tell you from my own experience, there is no business client who wants to have to deal with the immigration system and an immigration lawyer or law firm in particular if they can hire locally. Now, the caller previously made an interesting point about whether there's an agenda to keep a certain underclass working cheaply. I'm not going to jump in on that because I don't really have the perspective to
Peter
comment on
Vermont
it.
Peter from Vermont raised that issue.
And I think that, you know, given all equal choices, there Americans aren't going to take seasonal jobs as a rule, but you have a Jamaican apple picker who comes here for 6 months, makes more money than he could in Jamaica, goes back, and he's happy, the farm owner's happy, everybody wins in that situation, and there truly is no American alternative. And mechanization is good to a point, but every business model would use the most efficient means available. You know, farmers are not ideologues. They want their crops to be harvested. They want to maximize the return on their investment. And when they're calling for more people to come and pick fruit, it's not because they're bleeding heart lefties who, you know, want to see America change. They just want to make some money.
What about the businesses? I want to hear from both of you on this. Mark, to you, what about the businesses? We've talked a lot about immigration law in reference to the actual people who want to come here. What about the businesses? How have you seen the law change, Mark, in terms of how those companies who hire illegal immigrants are treated?
Well, businesses do, in fact, have outsized influence on immigration policy and always have. I mean, Congress voted to restrict immigration for decades before the 1920s, and business stopped it, got presidents one after the other to veto it until finally security concerns overcame that. More recently about illegal immigration, the reason we've had a kind of half-hearted and fluctuating policy on enforcing immigration laws is precisely because, mainly because of business obstruction, business lobbying, combined with the racial identity groups and the groups on the left working together with business, ironically, very closely and intimately together, to prevent enforcement of the immigration law. So that's why you have laws that look tough, because the way the law is written on a lot of enforcement issues, it actually could work if it were implemented, but then it's not implemented. It's, in political science, they call that client politics, where legislation is designed to look good to the public, but then when the actual nitty-gritty day-to-day work of enforcement comes into play, the lobbyist groups, the various, whether they're business or other groups, get their way most of the time.
Well, and that's probably why, gentlemen, correct me if I'm wrong, Ron, that's why we see states like Alabama, Arizona, Georgia, South Carolina taking immigration law into their own hands, right? I mean, what do you think is behind this trend of the state saying, look, feds, you're not doing it, we'll do it ourselves, thank you?
I think it's obviously a combination of factors. There are always political winds blowing one way or another. There are economic pressures on states, and that clearly motivates much of this. And frankly, and this is probably a point on which Mark and I will disagree, I think a lot of these laws are simply mean-spirited. And they are basically the states asserting themselves to the federal government on what has time and again been deemed to be a federal power. It is clearly enumerated in the Constitution. The Supreme Court has consistently found, and even in New Hampshire when we had, it was more like 7-8 years ago. With
2005, I think.
Yeah, New Ipswich and Hudson. The court found that it was a federal prerogative, that federalism trumped state enforcement, local enforcement. And at the time, our certain attorney general, Kelly Ayotte, decided not to appeal to the Supreme Court. And now she's in the Senate. And that decision, which was based on a sound interpretation of the Constitution, actually came back to haunt her during the Republican primary for Senate. So it's a complex situation. But I think that the key is to remember that it truly is a federal prerogative. And the pressure should be on the federal government to either be resourced appropriately or to be called out on what Mark calls the client politics of essentially turning the other cheek when certain constituencies are not following the law. The final point I'll make on this is simply that I was in a meeting in April trying to get congressional attention on this, and one of the congressmen said, Ron, I don't have a problem with what you're proposing. It just has to be legal. And I looked at the congressman and said, then make it legal. That's your call. These aren't moral issues, and we may also disagree on that. These are matters of what the law says, and we can decide to fix the situation with the 10 or so million undocumented people who are here. We can decide to address what Senator Gregg's office always called future flow and make it so that there is a more orderly system to come in and one that recognizes the global world in which we live and the realities of the economy in which we find ourselves now.
What do you think, though, Ron? The states would say, like Georgia and Alabama and Arizona, they would say, look, Congress hasn't listened. It's not following its own laws. So it's up to us to take action. Feds aren't doing anything.
And they keep finding themselves in federal court as a result. Not one of these laws has been implemented without litigation. Pieces of most of them have been at least enjoined in the meantime. And at the end of the day, the U.S. Supreme Court's going to weigh in on it, and it's going to be a very interesting analysis of what part of these components of restrictionism are legitimately handled by the state and what part are not.
Well, it'll be fascinating to see it get to the U.S. Supreme Court. And you're right. Everybody says it's going to get there. Gentlemen, I want to bring our callers back into our conversation. Bob is waiting in Manchester. Hi, Bob. You're on the air. Thanks for hanging on. Go ahead.
Well, it's a fascinating discussion. This is Bob Baines, former mayor of Manchester, and I'd like to weigh in on some of the issues and some of the earlier discussions, even about refugees coming into the city.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning to you. And, you know, I do agree, obviously, on the federal responsibility here, but some comments have been made periodically during these discussions about refugees. And I can tell you, during the time that I served as mayor from 2000 to 2006, I was out visiting businesses on a regular basis, weekly basis, and was told at that time without refugees and immigrants, the businesses would not have been able to stay in Manchester or expand in Manchester. I would go into businesses like Ostrom, Sylvania, where 16% of the workforce were immigrants and refugees. Companies like General Cable, where they have a tremendous immigrant population, Freed's Bakery, Jack Beck, you go right down the line. And without the influx of immigrants and refugees, we would not have the vibrant city that we have today. They have enhanced the city, the quality of life in the city, they've contributed to the workforce, and they've contributed to the economic expansion of the city. And people who are beating up on immigrants and refugees, I think, are losing sight of the contributions they have made to our community, not only in recent history, but in the entire history of our city.
So when was the moratorium, and it's nice to hear from you, former Mayor Baines, when was the moratorium on refugees put in
place?
Well,
we had an issue with Lutheran services at the time.
It was during your time in office,
yes,
right?
Yes, and by the way, I handled it very quietly, and no one even knew we did it, because I was concerned if it became out as a public issue, there'd be prejudice against the refugees in the community. It was certainly not their fault. The agency was not communicating effectively with the health department, the educational system, and other agencies in the community. And we had never had that kind of a communication with the international problem, with the International Institute of Manchester. I spent time on a regular basis at the International Institute working with Ann Sanderson. We knew who was coming in, how many were coming in. She worked with the health department, the educational system. So communication was never a problem. I don't want to, get into, what Mayor Gatsis is facing now, because I'm not there on a daily basis. But I know during the time that I served, we had excellent communication with the immigrant refugee services in Manchester. And the business community was telling me, Mayor, we need the immigrants and refugees if you want us to stay and expand our businesses in Manchester.
Interesting. Well, and Mark Krikorian, this gets back to what you said a little bit ago, that, a lot of businesses like having large numbers of immigrants and refugees to use as employees. What do you think about former Mayor Baines' comments, Mark?
Well, a lot of times what you see is local officials and local businesses can't see the forest for the trees. They're sincere in their concerns, and their points are often valid. But, for instance, let me take it away so as not to personalize it. Talk about Iowa. Governor of Iowa, a number of years ago, who's now Secretary of Agriculture, said he wanted an Iowa-specific immigration policy so that immigrants could come to Iowa without the restrictions that, are in federal law, because, they needed more people to go to Iowa. Well, why were people leaving Iowa in the first place? In other words, whatever the problems were, whether it was weather, whether it was high taxes, whether it was too much regulation, whatever it was, those things that caused Americans to not really want to live in Iowa, and I'll say, frankly, in Manchester or anywhere else, are the same kind of things that immigrants are eventually going to encounter. In other words, immigration in those kind of cases is just a crutch. It's a way of avoiding dealing with the underlying problems that create the economic problems of business flight or, college students not returning home after they graduate, that kind of stuff. It really is just a Band-Aid. It's not some kind of solution to the problems that people are identifying.
Well, and later on in the series, we'll dig more specifically into the economics of immigration. But gentlemen, as we look at some of these modern debates over immigration law, Mark, to you first, the federal government is in the process of implementing a program called Secure Communities. Just briefly, Mark, what is that, and how does that fit in with some of these trends of immigration law that we've talked about this hour?
Well, Secure Communities does something that probably regular people think has always been done all along. What it involves is when a person is arrested and booked by the police, in other words, not stopped for a ticket or anything, you're actually arrested and you come in and you have your fingerprints taken at the police station or at the sheriff's department. Those fingerprints under Secure Communities go not only to the FBI, which is where they've always gone anyway, but then also to Homeland Security's databases to see if there's an immigration warrant out for your arrest or if you've been deported previously, that sort of thing. And like I said, most people probably think that's already what's always been done, but it hasn't and still isn't in most jurisdictions. But starting at the end of the Bush administration, they launched this program called Secure Communities to basically, hook up all jurisdictions in the country so when their fingerprints are taken, when a criminal's fingerprints are taken, they're also checked against the immigration databases. It seems to me that it is sort of the bare minimum of immigration enforcement. If you're not for that, you're really not for enforcing immigration laws because it's so elementary and so obvious that it's the kind of thing that should go without saying.
Well, and Ron, in the Live Free or Die state, we have a lot of people who are concerned about government intrusion and privacy. What do you think? How's this going to play in New Hampshire?
Well, in New Hampshire, it's interesting because it's not always representative of what's going on in the country as a whole. We have a very well-staffed Immigration and Customs Enforcement Office. I can testify from personal experience that they are frustratingly efficient at apprehending people who are here illegally or who may be here illegally. And the fact of that that anyone can object to governments sharing information. I think that that era has passed. I mean, we don't know as lay people what is in all the government databases. But what we do know is that these things are never as straightforward as they are presented to be. And you have situations where there is misinformation. You have situations where there are too many people with the same name. You have situations where the information entered into the database is simply incorrect. You have every year or two I get a case where the government's trying to deport someone who actually is a U.S. citizen, unbeknownst to them, based on the operation of the law. So we just have to do all these things with caution. And we don't want to turn our local law enforcement, and New Hampshire has recently been through that with the public statements of the Manchester Police Chief Dave Mara, we don't want to turn them into immigration deputies. They have enough to do, they are under-resourced, and this should not be one of their primary concerns.
Speaking of how people present this information, Mark, what do you think, how have politicians used this issue, especially in the recent presidential primary, to define themselves to attract voters? What do you think?
We've seen more discussion of immigration in the Republican primary discussion than we have really in national campaigns, presidential campaigns, as far as I can remember. I mean, there's been much more extensive debate. Now, the debate hasn't always been at a particularly high level. I mean, much of it's focused on relatively small issues. Much of it's focused on, you know, fence, I'll build a bigger fence. No, I'll build an even bigger fence, you know, this kind of thing. But, you know, that's at least a starting point, you know, baby steps. And we've had more substantive discussion of immigration in this presidential election season than I think we've ever had before. And that can only be a good thing, because this is the kind of thing that needs to be publicly debated, because this really isn't or hasn't been a right-left issue, generally speaking. It's more an up-down issue, and people need to see political, you know, candidates for political office debating this substantively and frequently.
Well, and next week, John Huntsman will be with us, so we'll for sure ask him about immigration. Also, our big week-long series on immigration is next week, so stay tuned with us for that. Mark Krikorian, thank you very much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mark Krikorian, Executive Director of the Center for Immigration Studies in D.C., and Ron Abramson, good to have you. Thanks a lot for being
Thanks,
here.
Thanks, Laura. It was a pleasure.
Ron Abramson, New Hampshire lawyer.